his country, etc., etc. An interesting weakness, Chavez noted judiciously. People really are the same all over the world, aren't they? Different masks, but the same flesh underneath, Lialin pronounced, feeling ever more the teacher. The offhand remark was his best lesson of the day. Of all human lamentations, without doubt the most common is, if only I had known. But we can't know, and so days of death and fire so often begin no differently from those of love and warmth. Pierce Denton packed the car for the trip to Nashville. It was not a trivial exercise. Both twin girls had safety seats installed in the back of the Cresta, and in between went the smaller seat for their brand-new brother Matthew. The twin girls, Jessica and Janine, were 3.5 years old, having survived the terrible twos, or rather their parents had, and the parallel adventures of learning to walk and talk. Now, dressed in identical short purple dresses and white tights, they allowed Mom and Dad to load them into their seats. Matthew went in after them, restless and whining, but the girls knew that the vibration of the car would soon put him back to sleep, which is what he mostly did anyway, except when nursing from his mother's breasts. It was a big day, off for a weekend at grandmother's house. Pierce Denton, 27, was a police officer in Greenville, Tennessee's small municipal department, still attending night school to finish up his college degree, but with no further ambition other than to raise his family and live a comfortable life in the tree-covered mountains where a man could hunt and fish with friends, attend a friendly community church, and generally live as good a life as any person might desire. His profession was far less stressful than that of colleagues in other places, and he didn't regret that a bit. Greenville had its share of trouble, as did any American town, but far less than he saw on TV or read about in the professional journals that lay on tables in the station. At 8:15 in the morning, he backed onto the quiet street and headed off, first toward U.S. Route 11E. He was rested and alert with his usual 2 cups of morning coffee already at work, chasing away the cobwebs of a restful night, or as restful as one could be, with an infant sleeping in the same bedroom with him and his wife Candace. Within 15 minutes he pulled onto Interstate Highway 81, heading south with the morning sun behind him. Traffic was fairly light this Saturday morning, and unlike most police officers, Denton didn't speed, at least not with his family in the car. Rather, he cruised evenly at just under 70 miles per hour, just enough over the posted limit of 65 for the slight thrill of breaking the law just a little. Interstate 81 was typical of the American interstates, wide and smooth, even as it snaked southwest through the mountain range that had contained the first westward expansion of European settlers. At Newmarket, 81 merged with I-40, and Denton merged in with westbound traffic from North Carolina. Soon he would be in Knoxville. Checking his rearview mirror, he saw that both daughters were already lulled into a semi-conscious state, and his ears told him that Matthew was the same. To his right, Candy Denton was dozing as well. Their infant son had not yet mastered the skill of sleeping through the night, and that fact took its toll on his wife, who hadn't had as much as 6 straight hours of sleep since, well, since before Matt's birth, actually, the driver told himself. His wife was petite, and her small frame had suffered from the latter stages of pregnancy. Candy's head rested on the right side window, grabbing what sleep she could before Matthew woke up and announced his renewed hunger, though with a little luck that might just last until they got to Nashville. The only hard part of the drive, if you could call it that, was in Knoxville, a medium-sized city, mostly on the north side of the Tennessee River. It was large enough to have an inner-ring highway, I-640, which Denton avoided, preferring the direct path west. The weather was warm for a change. The previous 6 weeks had been one damned snow and ice storm after another, and Greenville had already exhausted its budget for road salt and overtime for the crews. He'd responded to at least 50 minor traffic accidents and 2 major ones, but mainly he regretted not having gotten the new Cresta to the car wash the previous night. The bright paint was streaked with salt, and he was glad the car came with underbody coating as a standard option, because his venerable old pickup truck didn't have that, and it was corroding down to junk even as it sat still in their driveway. Beyond that, it seemed a competent little car. A few inches more leg room would have been nice, but it was her car, not his, and she didn't really need the room. The automobile was lighter than his police radio car and had only half the engine power. That made for somewhat increased vibration, largely dampened out by the rubberized engine mounts, but still there. Well, he told himself, that helped the kids to clock out. They must have had even more snow here, he saw. Rock salt had accumulated in the center of his lane like a path of sand or something. Shame they had to use so much, really tore up the cars. But not his, Denton was sure, having read through all the specifications before deciding to surprise Candy with her red Cresta. The mountains that cut diagonally across this part of America are called the Great Smokies, a name applied, according to local lore, by Dan'l Boone himself. Actually, part of a single range that ran from Georgia to Maine and beyond, changing local names almost as often as it changed states. In this area, humidity from the numerous lakes and streams combined with atmospheric conditions to generate fog that occurred on a year-round basis. Will Snyder of Pilot Lines was on overtime, a profitable situation for the union driver. The Freuhoff trailer attached to his Kenworth diesel tractor was filled with rolls of carpeting from a North Carolina mill en route to a distributorship in Memphis for a major sale. An experienced driver, Snyder was perfectly happy to be out on a Sunday since the pay was better, and besides, football season was over and the grass wasn't growing yet. He fully expected to be home for dinner in any case. Best of all, the roads were fairly clear during this winter weekend, and he was making good time, the driver told himself, negotiating a sweeping turn to the right and down into a valley. "Uh-oh," he murmured to himself. It was not unusual to see fog here, close to the State Route 95 north exit, the one that headed off to the bomb people at Oak Ridge. There were a couple of trouble spots on I-40, and this was one. Damn fog. There were two ways to deal with this. Some break down slowly for fuel economy, or maybe just because they didn't like going slow. Not Snyder. A professional driver who saw major wrecks on the side of the highway every week, he slowed down immediately, even before visibility dropped below 100 yards. His big rig took its time stopping, and he knew a driver who'd converted some little Japanese roller skate into tinfoil, along with its elderly driver, and his time wasn't worth the risk. Not at time and a half, it wasn't. Smoothly downshifting, he did what he knew to be the smartest thing, and just to be sure, flipped on his running lights. Pierce Denton turned his head in annoyance. It was another Cresta, the sporty C-99 version that they made only in Japan so far. This one, black with a red stripe down the side, that whizzed past at 80 or a little over, his trained eye estimated. In Greenville, that would have been a $100 ticket and a stern lecture from Judge Tom Anders. Where had those two kids come from? He hadn't even noticed their approach in his mirror. Temporary tag. Two young girls, probably one had just got her license and her new car from Daddy to go with it, and was taking her friend out to demonstrate what real freedom was in America, Officer Denton thought. Freedom to be a damn fool and get a ticket your first day on the road. But this wasn't his jurisdiction, and that was a job for the state boys. Typical, he thought with a shake of the head. Chattering away, hardly watching the road, but it was better to have them in front than behind. Lord, Snyder breathed. Locals, he'd heard in a truck stop once, blamed it on the crazy people at Oak Ridge. Whatever the reason, visibility had dropped almost instantly to a mere 30 feet. Not good. He flipped his running lights to the emergency blinker setting and slowed down more. He'd never done the calculation, but at this weight his tractor-trailer rig needed over 60 feet to stop from 30 miles per hour, and that was on a dry road, which this one was not. On the other hand, no, he decided, no chances. He lowered his speed to 20. So it cost him half an hour. Pilots knew about this stretch of I-40, and they always said it was better to pay the time than to pay off the insurance deductible. With everything in hand, the driver keyed his CB radio to broadcast a warning to his fellow truckers. It was like being inside a ping-pong ball, he told them over Channel 19, and his senses were fully alert, staring ahead into a white mass of water vapor when the hazard was approaching from the rear. The fog caught them entirely by surprise. Denton's guess had been a correct one. Nora Dunn was exactly 8 days past her 16th birthday, 3 days past getting her temporary permit, and 49 miles into her sporty new C-99. First of all, she'd selected a wide, nice piece of road to see how fast it would go, because she was young, and her friend Amy Rice had asked. With the compact disc player going full blast and trading observations on various male school chums, Nora was hardly watching the road at all, because, after all, it wasn't all that hard to keep a car between the solid line to the right and the dashy one to the left, was it? And besides, there wasn't anybody in the mirror to worry about, and having a car was far better than a date with a new boy, because they always had to drive anyway, for some reason or other, as though a grown woman couldn't handle a car herself. The look on her face was somewhat startled when visibility went down to not very much. Nora couldn't estimate the exact distance, and she took her foot off the accelerator pedal, allowing the car to slow down from the previous cruising speed of 84. The road behind was clear, and surely the road ahead would be, too. Her driving teachers had told her everything she needed to know, but as with the lessons of all her other teachers, some she'd heard and some she had not. The important ones would come with experience. Experience, however, was a teacher with whom she was not yet fully acquainted and whose grading curve was far too steep for the moment at hand. She did see the running lights on the Freuhoff trailer, but she was new to the road, and the amber spots might have been street lights, except that most interstate highways didn't have them, a fact she hadn't been driving long enough to learn. It was scarcely a second's additional warning in any case. By the time she saw the gray square shadow, it was simply too late, and her speed was only down to 65. With the tractor-trailer's speed at 20, it was roughly the equivalent of hitting a 30-ton stationary object at 45 miles per hour. It was always a sickening sound. Will Snyder had heard it before, and it reminded him of a truckload of aluminum beer cans being crunched in a compressor, the decidedly unmusical crump of a car body's being crushed by speed and mass and laws of physics that he'd learned not in high school, but rather by experience. The jolt to the left rear corner of the trailer slewed the front end of the 40-foot van body to the right, but fortunately his low speed allowed him to maintain control enough to get his rig stopped quickly. Looking back and to his left, he saw the remains of that cute new Jap car that his brother wanted to get, and Snyder's first ill-considered thought was that they were just too damn small to be safe, as though it would have mattered under the circumstances. The center and right front were shredded, and the frame was clearly bent. A blink and further inspection showed red where clear glass was supposed to be. Oh, my God! Amy Rice was already dead, despite the flawless performance of her passenger side airbag. The speed of the collision had driven her side of the car under the trailer, where the sturdy rear fender designed to prevent damage to loading docks had ripped through the coachwork like a chainsaw. Nora Dunn was still alive but unconscious. Her new Cresta C-99 was already a total loss. Its aluminum engine block split, frame bent 16 inches out of true, and worst of all, the fuel tank, already damaged by corrosion, was crushed between frame members and leaking. Snyder saw the leaking gasoline. His engine still running, he quickly maneuvered his truck to the shoulder and jumped out, bringing his light red CO2 extinguisher. That he didn't quite get there in time saved his life. "What's the matter, Janine?"
"Jessica,"
the little girl insisted, wondering why people couldn't tell the difference, not even her father. "What's the matter, Jessica?" her father said with a patient smile.
"He's stinky,"
she giggled. "Okay," Pierce Denton sighed. He looked over to shake his wife's shoulder. That's when he saw the fog and took his foot off the gas.
"What's the matter, honey?"
"Matt did a job."
"Okay."
Candace unclipped her seatbelt and turned to look in the back.
"I wish you wouldn't do that, Candy,"
he turned too, just at the wrong time. As he did, the car drifted over to the right somewhat, and his eyes tried to observe the highway and the affairs within his wife's new car. Shit. His instinct was to maneuver to the left, but he was too far over to the other side to do that, a fact he knew even before his left-hand had turned the wheel all the way. Hitting the brakes didn't help either. The rear wheels locked on the slick road, causing the car to skid sideways into, he saw, another cresta. His last coherent thought was, is it the same one that... Despite the red color, Snyder didn't see it until the collision was inevitable. The trucker was still 20 feet away, jogging in, holding the extinguisher in his arms like a football. Jesus, Denton didn't have time to say. The first thought was that the collision wasn't all that bad. He'd seen worse. His wife was rammed by inertia into the crumpling right side, and that wasn't good, but the kids in the back were in safety seats. Thank God for that, and... The final deciding factor in the end of five lives was chemical corrosion. The gas tank like that in the C-99, never properly galvanized, had been exposed to salt on its trans-Pacific voyage, then even more on the steep roads of eastern Tennessee. The weld points on the tank were particularly vulnerable and came loose on impact. Distortion of the frame made the tank drag on the rough concrete surface. The underbody protection, never fully affixed, simply flaked off immediately, and another weak spot in the metal tank sprang open, and the body of the tank itself, made of steel, provided the spark, igniting the gasoline that spread forward for the moment. The searing heat of the fireball actually cleared the fog somewhat, creating a flash so bright that oncoming traffic panic-stopped on both sides of the highway. That caused a 3-car accident 100 yards away in the eastbound lanes, but not a serious one, and people leaped from their vehicles to approach. It also caught the fuel leaking from Nora Dunn's car, enveloping her with flames and killing the girl, who mercifully would never regain consciousness despite the blazing death that took her to his bosom. Will Snyder was close enough that he'd seen all 5 faces in the oncoming Red Cresta. A mother and a baby were the two he'd remember for the rest of his life. The way she was perched between the front seats, holding the little one, her face suddenly turned to see oncoming death, staring right at the truck driver. The instant fire was a horrid surprise, but Snyder, though he stopped jogging, did not halt his approach. The left rear door of the Red Cresta had popped open, and that gave him a chance, for the flames were mostly, if temporarily, on the left side of the wrecked automobile. He darted in with the extinguisher held up like a weapon as the flames came back toward the gas tank under the Red Cresta. The damning moment gave him but one brief instant to act, to pick the one child among 3 who alone might live in the inferno that was already igniting his clothes and burning his face, while the driving gloves protected the hands that blasted fire-retarding gas into the rear seat area. The cooling CO2 would save his life and one other. He looked amid the yellow sheets and expanding white vapor for the infant, but it was nowhere to be found, and the little girl in the left seat was screaming with fear and pain, right there, right in front of him. His gloved hands found and released the chrome buckle, and he yanked her clear of the child's safety seat, breaking her arm in the process, then jerking his legs to fling himself clear of the enveloping fire. There was a lingering snowbank just by the guardrail, and he dove into it, putting out his own burning clothing. Then he covered the child with the salt-heavy slush to do the same for her, his face stinging with pain that was the barest warning of what would soon follow. He forced himself not to turn. He could hear the screaming behind his back. But to return to the burning car would be suicide, and looking might only force him into it. Instead, he looked down at Jessica Denton, her face blackened, her breathing ragged, and prayed that a cop would appear quickly, and with him an ambulance. By the time that happened, 15 minutes later, both he and the child were deep in shock. Chapter 8. Fast Forwarding. The slow news day and the proximity to a city guaranteed media coverage of some kind, and the number and ages of the victims guaranteed more still. One of the local Knoxville TV stations had an arrangement with CNN, and by noon the story was the lead item on CNN NewsHour. A satellite truck gave a young local reporter the opportunity for a global coverage entry in his portfolio. He didn't want to stay in Knoxville forever, and the clearing fog gave the cameras a full view of the scene. Damn, Ryan breathed in his kitchen at home. Jack was taking a rare Saturday off, eating lunch with his family, looking forward to taking them to evening mass at St. Mary's, so that he could also enjoy a Sunday morning at home. His eyes took in the scene, and his hand set the sandwich down on the plate. Three fire trucks had responded, and four ambulances, two of which, ominously, were still there, their crews just standing around. The truck in the background was largely intact, though its bumper was clearly distorted. It was the foreground that told the story, however. Two piles of metal blackened and distorted by fire. Open doors into a dark, empty interior. A dozen or so state police officers standing around, their posture stiff, their lips tight, not talking, not trading the jokes that ordinarily went with their perspective on auto accidents. Then Jack saw one of them trade a remark with another. Both heads shook and looked down at the pavement 30 feet behind the reporter, who was droning on the way that they always did, saying the same things for the 100th time in his short career. Fog, high speed, both gas tanks, 6 people dead, 4 of them kids. This is Bob Wright reporting from Interstate 40 outside Oak Ridge, Tennessee, commercial. Jack returned to his lunch, stifling another comment on the inequity of daily life. There was no reason yet why he should know or do more. The cars were dripping water now, 300 air miles away from the Chesapeake Bay, because the arriving volunteer firemen had felt the need to wet everything down, knowing even then that it was an exercise wasted on the occupants. The forensic photographer shot his 3 rolls of 200-speed color, catching the open mouths of the victims to prove that they'd died screaming. The senior police officer responding to the scene was Sergeant Thad Nicholson. An experienced highway cop with 20 years of auto accidents behind him, he arrived in time to see the bodies removed. Pierce Denton's service revolver had fallen to the pavement, and that more than anything had identified him as a fellow police officer, even before the routine computer check of the tags had made the fact official. 4 kids, 2 little ones and 2 teens and 2 adults. You just never get used to that. It was a personal horror for Sergeant Nicholson. Death was bad enough, but a death such as this, how could God let it happen? 2 little children? Well, he did, and that was that. Then it was time to go to work. Hollywood, to the contrary, it was a highly unusual accident. Automobiles did not routinely turn into fireballs under any circumstances, and this one, his trained eyes saw at once, should not have been all that serious. Okay, there was one unavoidable fatality from the crash itself, the girl in the death seat of the first Cresta, who'd been nearly decapitated. But not the rest. There was no obvious reason for them. The first Cresta had rear-ended the truck at 40 or 50 miles of differential speed. Both airbags had deployed, and one of them ought to have saved the driver of the first car, he saw. The second car had hit at about a 30-degree angle to the first. Damned fool of a cop to make a mistake like that, Nicholson thought. But the wife hadn't been belted in. Maybe she'd been attending to the kids in the back and distracted her husband. Such things happened, and nobody could undo it now. Of the 6 victims, 1 had been killed by collision and the other 5 by fire. That wasn't supposed to happen. Cars were not supposed to burn, and so Nicholson had his people reactivate a crossover 0.5 mile back on the interstate so that the 3 accident vehicles could remain in place for a while. He got on his car radio to order up additional accident investigators from Nashville and to recommend notifying the local office of the National Transportation Safety Board. As it happened, one of the local employees of that federal agency lived close to Oak Ridge. The engineer, Rebecca Upton, was on the scene 30 minutes after receiving her call. A mechanical engineer and graduate of the nearby University of Tennessee, who'd been studying this morning for her PE exam, She donned her brand new official coveralls and started crawling around the wreckage, while the tow truck operators waited impatiently, even before the backup police team arrived from Nashville. 24, petite and red-haired, she came out from under the once red cresta with her freckled skin smudged and her green eyes teary from the lingering gasoline fumes. Sergeant Nicholson handed over a styrofoam cup of coffee that he'd gotten from a fireman. "What'd you think, ma'am?" Nicholson asked, wondering if she knew anything. She looked like she did, he thought, and she wasn't afraid to get her clothes dirty, a hopeful sign. "Both gas tanks," she pointed. "That one was sheared clean off. The other one was crumpled by the impact and failed. How fast was it?"
"The collision, you mean?" Nicholson shook his head.
"Not that fast. Ballpark guess, 40 to 50.
"I think you're right. The gas tanks have structural integrity standards, and this crash shouldn't have exceeded them."
She took the proffered handkerchief and wiped her face.
"Thanks, Sergeant."
She sipped her coffee and looked back at the wrecks, wondering.
"What are you thinking?"
Ms. Upton turned back.
"I'm thinking that six people..."
"Five," Nicholson corrected. "The trucker got one kid out."
"Oh, I didn't know. Shouldn't have happened. No good reason for it."
"It was an under-60 impact. Nothing really unusual about the physical factors. Smart money is there's something wrong with the car design."
"Where are you taking them?"
she asked, feeling very professional now.
"The cars? Nashville. I can hold them at headquarters if you want, ma'am."
She nodded.
"Okay, I'll call my boss. We're probably going to make this a federal investigation. Will your people have any problem with that?"
She'd never done that before, but knew from her manual that she had the authority to initiate a full NTSB inquiry. Most often known for handling the analysis of aircraft accidents, the National Transportation Safety Board also looked into unusual train and vehicle mishaps and had the authority to require cooperation of every federal agency in the pursuit of hard data. Nicholson had participated in one similar investigation. He shook his head.
"Ma'am, my captain will give you all the cooperation you can handle."
"Thank you."
Rebecca Upton almost smiled, but this wasn't the place for it.
"Where are the survivors? We'll have to interview them."
"Ambulance took them back to Knoxville. Just a guess, but they probably airlifted them to Shriners.
That hospital he knew had a superb burn unit."
"You need anything else, ma'am? We have a highway to clear."
"Please, be careful with the cars.
We'll treat it like criminal evidence, ma'am," Sergeant Nicholson assured the bright little girl with a fatherly smile.
All in all, Ms. Upton thought, not a bad day. Tough luck for the occupants of the cars, that went without saying, and the reality and horror of their deaths were not lost on her. But this was her job, and her first really worthwhile assignment since joining the Department of Transportation. She walked back to her car, a Nissan hatchback, and stripped off her coveralls, donning in their place her NTSB windbreaker. It wasn't especially warm, but for the first time in her government career, she felt as though she were really part of an important team doing an important job, and she wanted the world to know who she was and what she was doing.
"Hi," Upton turned to see the smiling face of a TV reporter.
"What do you want?" she asked briskly, having decided to act very businesslike and official.
"Anything you can tell us?"
He held the microphone low, and his cameraman, while nearby, wasn't turning tape at the moment.
"Only off the record," Becky Upton said after a second's reflection.
"Fair enough."
"Both gas tanks failed. That's what killed those people."
"Is that unusual?"
"Very," she paused. "There's going to be an NTSB investigation. There's no good reason for this to have happened, okay?"
"You bet."
Wright checked his watch. In another 10 minutes, he'd be live on satellite again, and this time he'd have something new to say, which was always good. The reporter walked away, head down, composing his new remarks for his global audience. What a great development. The National Transportation Safety Board was going to investigate the Motor Trend Car of the Year for a potentially lethal safety defect. No good reason for these people to have died. He wondered if his cameraman could get close enough to see the charred, empty child seats in the back of the other car. Good stuff. Ed and Mary Patricia Foley were in their top-floor office at CIA headquarters. Their unusual status had made for some architectural and organizational problems at the agency. Mary Pat was the one with the title of Deputy Director Operations, the first female to make that rank at America's lead spy agency. An experienced field officer who had worked her country's best and longest-lived agent in place, she was the cowboy half of the best husband-wife team CIA had ever fielded. Her husband Ed was less flashy, but more careful as a planner. Their respective talents in tactics and strategy were highly complementary, and though Mary Pat had won the top job, she'd immediately done away with her need for an executive assistant, putting Ed in that office and making him her equal, in real terms, if not bureaucratic ones. A new doorway had been cut in the wall so that he could stroll in without passing the executive secretary in the anteroom, and together they managed CIA's diminished collection of case officers. The working relationship was as close as their marriage, with all the compromises that attended the latter, and the result was the smoothest leadership of the Directorate of Operations in years. "We need to pick a name, honey." "How about fireman?" "Not firefighter." A smile. "They're both men." "Well, Yalin says they're doing fine on linguistics." "Good enough to order lunch and find the bathroom." Mastering the Japanese language was not a trivial intellectual challenge. "How much you want to bet they're speaking it with a Russian accent?" A light bulb went off in both their minds at about the same time. "Cover identities." "Yeah," Mary Pat almost laughed. "Do you suppose anyone will mind?" It was illegal for CIA officers to adopt the cover identities of journalists, American journalists, that is. The rule had recently been redrafted at Ed's urging to point out that quite a few of the agents his officers recruited were third world journalists. Since both the officers assigned to the operation spoke excellent Russian, they could easily be covered as Russian journalists, couldn't they? It was a violation of the spirit of the rule, but not the letter. Ed Foley had his cowboy moments, too. "Oh, yeah," said Mary Pat. "Clark wants to know if we would like him to take a swing at reactivating Thistle." "We need to talk to Ryan or the president about that," Ed pointed out, turning conservative again. "But not his wife." "No, we don't. We need to get approval to make use of the network, not to see if it's still there." Her ice-blue eyes twinkled as they usually did when she was being clever. "Honey, that's calling it a little close," Ed warned, but that was one of the reasons he loved her. "But I like it." "Okay, as long as we're just seeing that the network still exists." "I was afraid I was going to have to pull rank on you, dear," for which transgressions her husband exacted a wonderful toll. "Just so you have dinner ready on time, Mary. The orders will go out Monday." "Have to stop at the Giant on the way home. We're out of bread." Congressman Alan Trent of Massachusetts was in Hartford, Connecticut, taking a Sunday off to catch a basketball game between UMass and UConn, both of whom looked like contenders for the regional championship this year. That didn't absolve him from the need to work, however, and so two staffers were with him, while a third was due in with work. It was more comfortable in the Sheraton Hotel adjacent to the Hartford Civic Arena than in his office, and he was lying on the bed with the papers spread around him, rather like Winston Churchill, he thought, but without the champagne nearby. The phone next to his bed rang. He didn't reach for it. He had a staffer for that, and Trent had taught himself to ignore the sound of a ringing phone. "Al, it's George Wiley from Deerfield Auto." Wiley was a major contributor to Trent's political campaigns and the owner of a large business in his district. For both of those reasons, he was able to demand Trent's attention whenever he desired it. "How the hell did he track me down here?" Trent asked the ceiling as he reached for the phone. "Hey, George, how are you today?" Trent's two aides watched their boss set his soda down and reach for a pad. The congressman always had a pen in his hand and a nearby pad of post-it notes. Seeing him scribble a note to himself wasn't unusual, though the angry look on his face was. Their boss pointed to the TV and said, "CNN." The timing turned out to be almost perfect. After the top-of-the-hour commercial and a brief intro, Trent was the next player to see the face of Bob Wright. This time he was on tape, which had been edited. It now showed Rebecca Upton in her NTSB windbreaker and the two crumbled Crestas being hauled aboard the wreckers. Shit, Trent's senior staffer observed. The gas tank's here, Trent asked over the phone, then listened for a minute or so. Those motherfuckers, the congressman snarled next. Thanks for the heads up, George, I'm on it. He set the phone receiver back in the cradle and sat up straighter in the bed. His right hand pointed to his senior aide. Get in touch with the NTSB watch team in Washington. I want to talk to that girl right away. Name, phone, where she is. Track her down fast. Next, get the Sectrans on the phone. His head went back down to his working correspondence while his staffers got on the phones. Like most members of Congress, Trent essentially time-shared his brain, and he'd long since learned to compartmentalize his time and his passion. He was soon grumbling about an amendment to the Department of the Interior's authorization for the National Forest Service, and making a few marginal notes with a green pen. This was his second highest expression of outrage, though his staff saw his red pen poised near a fresh page on a legal pad. The combination of foolscap and a red pen meant that Trent was really exercised about something. Rebecca Upton was in her Nissan following the wreckers to Nashville, where she would first supervise the initial storage of the burned-out Crestas and then meet with the head of the local office to begin the procedures for a formal investigation. Lots of paperwork, she was sure, and the engineer found it odd that she was not upset at her wrecked weekend. Along with her job came a cellular phone, which she assiduously used only for official business and only when absolutely necessary. She'd been in federal employ for just 10 months, which meant, in her case, that she'd never even reached the basic monthly fee which the company charged the government. The phone had never rung in her car before, and she was startled by the sound when it started warbling next to her. "Hello?" she said, picking it up, wondering if it were a wrong number. "Rebecca Upton?" "That's right. Who's this?" "Please hold for Congressman Trent," a male voice told her. "Who?"
"Hello," a new voice said.
"Who's this?"
"Are you Rebecca Upton?"
"Yes, I am. Who are you?"
"I am Alan Trent, member of Congress from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts."
Massachusetts, as any elected official from that state would announce at the drop of a hat, was not a mere state.
"I tracked you down through the NTSB Watch Center. Your supervisor is Michael Zimmer, and his number in Nashville is..."
"Okay, I believe you, sir. What can I do for you?"
"You're investigating a crash on I-40, correct?"
"Yes, sir."
"I want you to fill me in on what you know."
"Sir," Upton said, slowing her car down so that she could think, "we haven't even really started it yet, and I'm not really in a position to..."
"Young lady, I'm not asking you for conclusions, just for the reason why you are initiating an investigation. I am in a position to help. If you cooperate, I promise you that the Secretary of Transportation will know what a fine young engineer you are. She's a friend of mine, you see. We worked together in Congress for 10 or 12 years.
Oh, Rebecca Upton thought. It was improper, unethical, probably against the rules, and maybe even fattening to reveal information from an ongoing NTSB accident investigation. On the other hand, the investigation hadn't started yet, had it? And Upton wanted to be noticed and promoted as much as the next person. She didn't know that her brief silence was as good as mind-reading to the other person on the cellular circuit and couldn't see the smile in the Hartford hotel room in any case.
"Sir, it appears to me and to the police who responded to the accident that both gas tanks on both cars failed, causing a fatal fire. There appears, on first inspection, to be no obvious mechanical reason for the tanks to have done so. Therefore, I am going to recommend to my supervisor that we initiate an investigation to determine the cause of the incident."
"Both gas tanks leaked?" the voice asked.
"Yes, sir, but it was worse than a leak. Both failed, rather badly."
"Anything else you can tell me?" Not really at this time, no.
Upton paused.
Would this guy really mention her name to the secretary?
If so.
Something is not right about this, Mr. Trent. Look, I have a degree in engineering, and I minored in materials science. The speed of the impact does not justify two catastrophic structural failures. There are federal safety standards for the structural integrity of automobiles and their components, and those parameters far exceed the conditions I saw at the accident scene. The police officers I spoke with agree. We need to do some tests to be sure, but that's my gut call for the moment. I'm sorry I can't tell you any more for a while.
This kid is going far, Trent told himself in his room at the Hartford Sheraton.
Thank you, Miss Upton. I left my number with your office in Nashville. Please call me when you get in.
Trent hung up the phone and thought for a minute or so. To his junior staffer, call Sectrans and tell her that this Upton kid's very good.
No, get her for me and I'll tell her. Paul, how good is the NTSB lab for doing scientific testing? He asked,
looking and feeling more and more like Churchill, planning the invasion of Europe.
Well, Trent told himself, not quite that.
Not bad at all, but the varsity.
Right.
Trent selected a free button on his phone and made another call from memory.
Good afternoon, Congressman, Bill Shaw said to his speakerphone, looking up at Dan Murray.
By the way, we need to see you next week, and
I need some help, Bill.
What kind of help is that, sir?
Elected officials were always sir or ma'am on official business, even for the director of the FBI. That was especially true if the congressman in question chaired the Intelligence Committee, along with holding a seat on the Judiciary Committee and another on Ways and Means. Besides which, for all his personal eccentricities, Trent had always been a good friend and fair critic of the Bureau. But the bottom line was simpler. All three of his committee jobs had impact on the FBI. Shaw listened and took some notes.
The Nashville SAC is Bruce Cleary, but we require a formal request for assistance from DOT before we can...
Okay, sure, I'll await her call. Glad to help.
Yes, sir. Bye.
Shaw looked up from his desk.
Why the hell is Al Trent worked up over a car wreck in Tennessee?
Why are we interested? Murray asked more to the point.
He wants the lab division to back up NTSB on forensics. You want to call Bruce and tell him to get his best tech guy on deck? The friggin' accident just happened this morning, and Trent wants results yesterday.
Has he ever jerked us around on something before?
Shaw shook his head.
Never. I suppose we want to be on his good side. He'll have to sit in on the meeting with the chairman. We're going to have to discuss Kielty's security clearance, remember?
Shaw's phone buzzed.
Secretary of Transportation on 3, Director.
That boy, Murray observed, is really kicking some serious ass for a Saturday afternoon.
He got out of his chair and headed for a phone on the other side of the room while Director Shaw took the call from the Cabinet Secretary.
Get me the Nashville office.
The police impound yard where wrecked or stolen vehicles were stored was part of the same facility that serviced state police cars. Rebecca Upton had never been there before, but the record drivers had, and following them was easy enough. The officer in the gatehouse shouted instructions to the first driver, and the second followed, trailed by the NTSB engineer. They ended up heading to an empty area, or almost empty. There were 6 cars there, 2 marked and 4 unmarked police radio cars, plus 10 or so people, all of them senior by the look of them. One was Upton's boss, and for the first time she was really aware of how serious this affair was becoming. The service building had 3 hydraulic lifts. Both Crestas were unloaded outside it, then manhandled inside and onto the steel tracks. Both were hoisted simultaneously, allowing the growing mob of people to walk underneath. Upton was by far the shortest person there and had to jostle her way in. It was her case, after all, or so she thought. A photographer started shooting film, and she noticed that the man's camera case had FBI printed on it in yellow lettering.
What the hell?
Definite structural failure, noted a captain of the state police, the department's chief of accident investigation. Other heads nodded sagely. Who has the best science lab around here? Someone in casual clothing asked.
Vanderbilt University would be a good place to start, Rebecca announced. Better yet, Oak Ridge National Laboratory.
You Miss Upton? The man asked. I'm Bruce Cleary, FBI. Why are you... Ma'am, I just go where they send me. He smiled and went on. DOT's requested our help on the investigation. We have a senior tech from our laboratory division flying down from Washington right now. On a DOT aircraft, no less, he didn't say. Neither he nor anyone else in his office had ever investigated an auto accident, but the orders came from the director himself, and that was really all he needed to know. Ms. Upton suddenly felt herself to be a sapling in a forest of giants, but she, too, had a job to do, and she was the only real expert on the scene. Taking a flashlight from her pocket, she started a detailed examination of the gas tank. Rebecca was surprised when people gave her room. It had already been decided that her name would go on the cover of the report. The involvement of the FBI would be downplayed, an entirely routine case in interagency cooperation, backing up an inquiry initiated by a young, dedicated, bright, female NTSB engineer. She would take the lead on the case. Rebecca Upton would get all the credit for the work of the others because it could not appear that this was a concerted effort toward a predetermined goal, even though that's precisely what it was. She had also begun this thing, and for delivering political plums this large, there had to be a few seeds tossed out for the little people. All the men standing around either knew or had begun to suspect it, though not all of them had begun to grasp what the real issues were. They merely knew that a congressman had gotten the immediate attention of a cabinet secretary and the director of the government's most powerful independent agency, and that he wanted fast action. It appeared that he'd get it, too. As they looked up at the underside of what only a few hours before had been a family car on the way to Grandma's house, the cause of the disaster seemed as straightforward as a punch in the nose. All that was really needed, the senior FBI representative thought, was scientific analysis of the crumpled gas tank. For that, they'd go to Oak Ridge, whose lab facilities often backed up the FBI. That would require the cooperation of the Department of Energy, but if Al Trent could shake two large trees in less than an hour, how hard would it be for him to shake another? Goto was not a hard man to follow, though it could be tiring, Numuri thought. At 60, he was a man of commendable vigor and a desire to appear youthful, and he always kept coming here at least 3 times per week. This was the tea house that Kazuo had identified, not by name, but closely enough that Numuri had been able to identify, then confirm it. He'd seen both Goto and Yamata enter here, never together, but never more than a few minutes apart, because it would be unseemly for the latter to make the former wait too much. Yamata always left first, and the other always lingered for at least an hour, but never more than 2. Supposition, he told himself. A business meeting followed by R&R, and on the other nights just the R&R part. As though in some cinematic farce, Goto always came out with a blissful swagger to his stride as he made his way toward the waiting car. Certainly, the driver knew. The open door, a bow, then the mischievous grin on his face as he came around to his own door. On every other occasion, Numuri had followed Goto's car discreetly and very carefully, twice losing him in the traffic, but on the last 2 occasions and 3 others he'd tracked the man all the way to his home and felt certain that his destination after his trysts was always the same. Okay. Now he would think about the other part of the mission as he sat in his car and sipped his tea. It took 40 minutes. It was Kimberly Norton. Numuri had good eyes, and the streetlights were bright enough for him to manage a few quick frames from his camera before exiting the car. He tracked her from the other side of the street, careful not to look directly at her, instead allowing his peripheral vision to keep her in sight. Surveillance and counter-surveillance were part of the syllabus at the farm. It wasn't too hard, and this subject made it easy. Even though she wasn't overly tall by American standards, she did stand out here, as did her fair hair. In Los Angeles, she would have been unremarkable, Nomori thought, a pretty girl in a sea of pretty girls. There was nothing unusual about her walk. The girl was adapting to local norms, slightly demure, giving way to men, whereas in America the reverse was both true and expected. And though her Western clothing was somewhat distinctive, many people on the street dressed the same way. In fact, traditional garb was in the minority here, he realized with a slight surprise. She turned right down another street, and Nomori followed 60 or 70 yards behind, like he was a goddamn private detective or something. What the hell was this assignment all about? The CIA officer wondered. Russians? Ding asked. Freelance journalist, no less. How's your shorthand? Clark asked, reading over the telex. Mary Pat was having another attack of the clevers, but truth be told, she was very good at it. He'd long suspected that the agency had a guy inside the Interfax news agency in Moscow. Maybe CIA had played a role in setting the outfit up, as it was often the first and best source of political information from Moscow. But this was the first time so far as he knew that the agency had used it for a cover legend. The second page of the op order got even more interesting. Clark handed it over to Lyalin without comment. Bloody about time, the former Russian chuckled. You will want names, addresses, and phone numbers, yes? That would help, Oleg Gurevich. You mean we're going to be in the real spy business? Chavez asked. It would be his first time ever. Most of the time he and Clark had been paramilitary operators, doing jobs either too dangerous or too unusual for regular field officers. It's been a while for me, too, Ding. Oleg, I never asked what language you used working your people. Always English, Lyalin answered. I never let on my abilities in Japanese. I often picked up information that way. They thought they could chat right past me. Cute, Clark thought. You just stood there with the open-mouthed dog look on your face, and people never seemed to catch you. Except that in his case and Ding's, it would be quite real. Well, the real mission wasn't to play spymaster, was it? And they were prepared enough for what they were supposed to do, John told himself. They would leave on Tuesday for Korea. In yet another case of interagency cooperation, a UH-1H helicopter of the Tennessee National Guard lifted Rebecca Upton, three other men, and the gasoline tanks to Oak Ridge National Laboratory. The tanks were wrapped in clear plastic and were strapped into place as though they were passengers themselves. Oak Ridge's history went back to the early 1940s when it had been part of the original Manhattan Engineering Project, the cover name for the first atomic bomb effort. Huge buildings housed the still-operating uranium separation machinery, though much else had changed, including the addition of a helipad. The Huey circled once to get a read on the wind, then settled in. An armed guard shepherded the party inside, where they found a senior scientist and two lab techs waiting. The Secretary of Energy himself had called them in this Saturday evening. The scientific side of the case was decided in less than an hour. More time would be required for additional testing. The entire NTSB report would address such issues as the seat belts, the efficacy of the child safety seats in the Denton car, how the airbags had performed, and so forth. But everyone knew that the important part, the cause of five American deaths, was that the Cresta gas tanks had been made of improperly treated steel that had corroded down to a third of its expected structural strength. The rough draft of that finding was typed out badly on a nearby word processor, printed, and faxed to DOT headquarters adjacent to the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum in Washington. Though preliminary finding was the header on the two-page memo, the information would be treated as holy writ. Most remarkably of all, Rebecca Upton thought, it had all been accomplished in less than 16 hours. She'd never seen the government move so fast on anything. What a shame that it didn't always do that, she thought, as she dozed off in the back of the helicopter during the return flight to Nashville. Later that night, the University of Massachusetts lost to the University of Connecticut 108-103 in overtime. Though a fanatic follower of basketball and a graduate of UMass, Trent smiled serenely as he walked out into the shopping concourse outside the Hartford Civic Arena. He'd scored in a far bigger game today, he thought, though the game was not what he thought it was. Arnie Van Dam didn't like being awakened early on a Sunday morning, especially on one that he had designated as a day of rest, a day for sleeping till 8 or so, reading his papers at the kitchen table like a normal citizen, napping in front of the TV in the afternoon, and generally pretending that he was back in Columbus, Ohio, where the pace of life was a lot easier. His first thought was that there had to be a major national emergency. President Durling wasn't one to abuse his chief of staff, and few had his private number. The voice on the other end caused his eyes to open wide and glare at the far wall of his bedroom. "Al, this better be good," he growled at 7:15. Then he listened for a few minutes. "Okay, wait a minute. Okay." A minute later, he was lighting up his computer. Even he had to use one in these advanced times, which was linked to the White House. A phone was next to it. "Okay, Al, I can squeeze you in tomorrow morning at 8:15. Are you sure about all this?" He listened for another couple of minutes, annoyed that Trent had suborned three agencies of the executive branch. But he was a member of Congress, and a powerful one at that, and the exercise of power came as easily to him as swimming did to a duck. "My question is, will the president back me up?" "If your information is solid, yes, I expect that he will, Al. This is the one, Arnie. I've talked and talked and talked, but this time the bastards have killed people. Can you fax me the report? I'm running to catch a plane. I'll have it to you as soon as I get to my office." "So why did you have to call me now?" Van Dam didn't snarl. "I'll be waiting for it," was what he said. His next considered move was to retrieve the Sunday papers from his front porch. Remarkable, he thought, scanning the front pages. The biggest story of the day, maybe of the year, and nobody had picked up on it yet. Typical. Remarkably, except for the normal activity on the fax machine, the remainder of the day went largely according to plan, which allowed the presidential chief of staff to act like a normal citizen, and not even wonder what the following day might bring. It would keep, he told himself, dozing off on his living room sofa and missing the Lakers and the Celts from Boston Garden. Chapter 9. Power Plays. There were more chits to be called in that Monday, but Trent had quite a few of them out there. The United States House of Representatives would open for business per usual at noon. The chaplain intoned his prayer, surprised to see that the Speaker of the House himself was in his seat instead of someone else, that there were over 100 members to listen to him instead of the usual 6 or 8 queued to make brief statements for the benefit of the C-SPAN cameras, and that the press gallery was almost half full instead of entirely empty. About the only normal factor was the public gallery with the customary number of tourists and school kids. The chaplain, unexpectedly intimidated, stumbled through his prayer of the day and departed, or started to. He decided to linger at the door to see what was going on. "Mr. Speaker," a voice announced, to the surprise of no one on the floor of the chamber. The Speaker of the House was already looking that way, having been prepped by a call from the White House. "The chair recognizes the gentleman from Massachusetts." Al Trent walked briskly down to the lectern. Once there, he took his time, setting his notes on the tilted wooden platform, while three aides set up an easel, making his audience wait, and establishing the dramatic tone of his speech with eloquent silence. Looking down, he began with the required litany. "Mr. Speaker, I request permission to revise and extend." "Without objection," the Speaker of the House replied, but not as automatically as usual. The atmosphere was just different, a fact clear to everyone but the tourists, and their tour guides found themselves sitting down, which they never did. Fully 80 members of Trent's party were in their seats, along with 20 or so on the other side of the aisle, including every member of the minority leadership who happened to be in Washington that day. and though some of the latter were studies in disinterested posture, the fact that they were here at all was worthy of comment among the reporters who had also been tipped that something big was happening.
Mr. Speaker, on Saturday morning on Interstate Highway 40 between Knoxville and Nashville, Tennessee, 5 American citizens were condemned to a fiery death by the Japanese auto industry.